using fear and guilt to control populations is kind of the oldest trick in the book. The UK cannot meaningfully influence the global climate through reduction of its emissions. Leaving international agreements and repealing the Climate Change Act is necessary to abolish net zero.
Hello, and a warm welcome to the Reform Party podcast. Today, I've got a very special guest, and it's Annika Sweetland. Hello, Annika.
Hello, Ken.
Hi. You've had a busy time recently, haven't you? Because last month you were in Zurich, was it?
Yes.
And you gave what has become a very popular speech to the World Prosperity Forum. And then last week you were on GB News with Lee Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And am I right in saying that next month you're publishing a new paper?
Yes, correct. Yeah, so the paper is a policy paper on net zero. My background is in climate science, and then I worked for the Australian government in policy, energy policy. So, you know, I just came to the point where I was like, right, I just need to write a paper on this and kind of get it out of my system. Because as you know, the state of things in this country has gone seriously downhill since, after 20 or 30 years of climate agreements.
Am I allowed to say that I've seen the paper? I have read it, and it's absolutely brilliant in my view. It takes on in meaningful terms, in terms that people will readily understand, what has been going on in the climate change industry over the last 30, 40 years. So I think it's going to be very successful.
Thank you. Yeah, we're launching it next month, I believe. It's currently being published by the Bruges Group. So,
Well, I'll certainly make sure it's circulated. I mean, are you working with Reform on energy policy or?
Not yet officially. I have been chatting to them about it. I definitely hope to.
Right.
That is definitely something that I would love to offer Reform and the country when Reform get into power. I think energy policy is such a important area for the economy that you definitely need the right people doing it.
Yeah. Well, I've taken an interest in the climate thing since way back in the 90s, I guess. And do you want to just talk people through the various cycles that we've had over the last 20, 30 years in terms of how the climate debate has been and how it's moved on and how it's changed?
Yeah. So there's no dispute as to whether, you know, the climate is changing. And I think one of the most problematic parts of this argument is the language that's used. So because it's called climate change, and then that's made out to be a really bad or scary thing, the climate does change. It always has, long before we were here, and it will do long after we're here. It's due to natural processes that have been taking place for hundreds of million years. It's entirely predictable. And as humans, we could never stop it. So that's kind of why it's helpful at the outset, just to distinguish between man-made climate change, or the idea of man-made climate change, and what I call natural climate change, which really should have been the climate change we all learned about in school. But this has been a story that has been going since really the late 60s. And, you know, I've had people come up to me at Reform meetings and say, that when they were in school, they were afraid of this ice age. And that was the story back then. So in the 70s, it was all about this impending ice age. And then that shifted in the late 80s to global warming. But I think somewhere in the middle, maybe while you were at school, Ken, were you always in fear of nuclear war at school? I mean, were you doing drills in your classroom and that sort of thing?
Well, I can't quite remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, but just very, very vaguely. But yeah, I have to say, I mean, they have tried to use fear to control the population for years over many different subjects. And I became convinced quite early on that they were using the fear of climate change for exactly that purpose.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, using fear and guilt to control populations is kind of the oldest trick in the book. governments, corporations, NGOs, religious groups, they all use this tactic. And I mean, myself with the climate story, this is something I've been told since I was a young girl at school. And at the time, it made me feel fairly anxious. And this is something that, is seen in the 80s when escalations rose in the Cold War missile era. A lot of teenagers in that time were anxious, and that is actually where the kind of punk era came from, kind of a fatalistic, no future subculture.
Yep.
So I don't know what you think
I
about
remember
that,
that bit, Annika.
Ken. Yeah. Happy to get into, well, it definitely produced some good music, didn't it?
Did. It didn't have.
Yeah, so, but basically, the fear creates urgency and guilt creates moral pressure. And the emotional formula back then and for all of these cycles was identical to today. So you show distant suffering, and I talk about this in my paper. So 177,000 potential climate change refugees. You tell the audience that climate change has caused it. You suggest that the only major interventions that can solve it are political and economic. And then you say, we don't actually have time to properly scrutinize this because time is of the essence. And then they heavily imply that if we resist these interventions, we're complicit in the suffering. And it's a classic tactic. You make the public feel guilty and afraid. So in this headspace, this is our flight and fight response. And actually, in this space of fear, we're actually a lot more compliant. And this is kind of the psychology behind it. And it's a classic tactic. You make the public feel guilty and afraid, and they'll be far less likely to question whatever solution is rolled out in response.
And it's worked terribly well, hasn't it? Because if you look at our young people in particular, the people who are going for Extinction Rebellion and all these kinds of extreme, nasty, extreme movements, who are on the climate change bandwagon, effectively, these people, the reason they go for these extremes is because they're terrified, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. You're 100% spot on there. I was terrified at university. And it also made me very upset, maybe a bit depressed, anxious, and completely just disillusioned with the world because not only are you terrified, but you're forced into believing that actually no one cares and no one is doing anything. So it can definitely send you crazy. I think it's a story that, well, we've seen what these extreme people on the left are like. They can get very violent, very abrupt. Yeah, and it is driven by fear, I'm sure of it.
And of course, they used very much similar tactics for the COVID epidemic, didn't they?
I was actually quite naive back then, which was quite nice. I thought the government was looking after us.
And
So,
Australia was one of the worst ones, wasn't it?
One of the worst lockdowns in Melbourne,
Yeah.
yes. Where I'm from, Perth, Western Australia, I mean, it's just so big that they just
Let you get
basically
on with
shut
it.
the border and it was business as usual. I think they
Yeah.
had two mini lockdowns of like 3 or 4 days or something. But actually, it's also something that's happening right now with free speech in the UK. All of these people being locked up for tweets and saying the wrong thing. It's crossed my mind. Should I kind of be speaking out about climate change? Am I going to get locked up? And an act that the EU passed just a couple of weeks ago, they are going, I know, they're on a projectile to make speaking out against man-made climate change illegal. They're calling telling the truth about climate change, i.e., that it's natural and that we don't actually have anything to fear. They are labeling that misinformation. And I think that things could get really bad before they get good. And I wouldn't be surprised if, people, well, yeah, maybe got locked up for it.
So there are two things here, really, isn't there? First of all, there's what your view is on climate change. Now, it seems to me that you and I probably both agree that it's a scam and that the governments are using it to control populations, etc. But even if you seed that and say, well, for somebody who doesn't believe that, we've got a particular problem in the UK, haven't we? Because we've got a government who is imposing something called net zero, which even if you accept that climate is changing and that man is causing it. Can you explain why it is that net zero is so illogical?
Basically, even if it was all true, the UK cannot meaningfully influence the global climate through reduction of its emissions. Even if we got all the way to net zero, there'll be no measurable or meaningful change to the Earth's climate. And this is because we only contribute 1% of global emissions. So if you take that 1% away, you're still left with 99%. I mean, it's completely a drop in the ocean, unfortunately.
The what we are doing in terms of harming ourselves through the net zero policies, industrially and economically and so on, makes no sense because even if you say, as you say, even if we were to achieve net zero, it has no impact on climate whatsoever.
And this is when the penny kind of dropped for me. I thought, well, if the government actually thought that we were moving towards this impending natural disaster, wouldn't they be wanting to increase food security and increase energy security? But net zero is doing completely the opposite. I mean, because we're not allowed to explore our gas fields, which has actually just became illegal, by the way. Since that is illegal, that makes us more dependent on other countries for gas. And when they just decide they don't have enough, we're going to get cut off. We're not even going to be able to drive our electric cars because we won't be able to charge them. I mean, it's really, really scary situation we're getting ourselves into. And people don't actually realize that we almost ran out of our gas reserves, very recently. And yeah, the fact that we're also putting solar panels on farmland, that reduces our food security because we're putting it on some of our most productive farmland in Lancashire, for example, as you will have seen.
Well, we have a we I live in the Wirral, which is north of England, Cheshire, just south of Liverpool, and we have a particular problem at the minute because we had they're putting in a carbon capture and storage scheme in this area, and this involves laying huge carbon dioxide pipes and so on, and basically churning up the land, all and the idea is that they're spending £22 billion. Which event to take the carbon and bury it out underneath the Irish Sea, and so we are having huge meetings. I've got a meeting tonight where I think there's 160 people coming to protest about this the imposition of these carbon capture and storage schemes. Have you any knowledge of these?
What I do know is that it just makes my blood boil because carbon dioxide is actually really good for the planet. And, it's plant food. And, in university, I was taught that trees were going to starve due to climate change. And they intentionally used the word starve because they knew we all loved the environment, hence we were doing the course. But actually, in commercial greenhouses, they actually pump carbon dioxide into them to 1400 parts per million because it grows the best plants and they also use the least water when there's lots of carbon dioxide. So NASA's satellite imagery actually shows a 10% greening of the Earth between 2000 and 2020. So actually, the mainstream media wants to make out this picture that the earth is becoming desolate and dying, but actually it's flourishing because of the extra carbon dioxide. Yeah.
Crop yields were up sort of 15%, I think,
Yes,
because of
exactly.
the
And
additional
they're
carbon in
saying
the
it's going to
atmosphere.
cause famine. I mean, it just couldn't be more illogical. And that's kind of the whole problem with me because people can be irrational, sure, but just no logic whatsoever. They're saying carbon dioxide is bad for the planet. It's actually scientifically proven to be really good for the planet. I mean, that's how photosynthesis occurs. That's how we're actually alive, is due to carbon dioxide.
Let me just ask you, you say you're not formally involved with reform yet, but hope that may change. Can I ask you what your view is on how gung-ho reform should be in terms of climate change? Because what I've seen with people interviewed about it, and now we're quite clear, we're opposed to net zero. We don't want it, and that's a clear policy. Presumably, we're opposed to carbon capture and storage as well, so that's fine. But I've seen, and it happens quite often with journalists, mainstream media journalists, who will get somebody from Reform, and they'll say, right, what's your policy on climate change? And you say, oh, well, we're against net zero. No, ask on climate change, are you a climate change denier? And of course, this is the terminology they use, which harks back, of course, to the Holocaust deniers sort of meme. And in most cases, when they get to that stage, they were refused to take that extra step and say, yeah, we don't believe in climate change. We think climate change is a scam. Now, I haven't seen anybody yet from the top of the party yet being prepared to take that next step. Do you think they should?
Look, I don't think that Nigel Farage ever has the need to openly state something so controversial. I think that actions speak louder than words. Leaving international agreements and repealing the Climate Change Act is necessary to abolish net zero. So I think that will make enough of a statement. I can kind of get away with it because it's what I studied. And
And I can get away with
that's
it because
actually why
I'm just a
the
podcaster. Nobody listens.
No, but that's why the internet trolls hate me so much because I'm actually qualified to have an opinion on it. Apparently, you need to have a degree in it to talk about it these days. So, if it were up to me and I had a journalist saying that and it got to that point and said, "So, are you a denier?" I would say something like, "Look, we need to be thinking about the future generation. We need to make sure that children are learning factual information in schools. And therefore, we will be teaching natural climate change. Natural climate change is a huge part of our lives. The climate changes all the time. There's 1500 year cycles, and these are warming and cooling cycles. And then you have the bigger picture, which is the ice age cycles, which is about every 100,000 years. So the Earth naturally moves in and out of ice ages and it warms and cools. So from 1400 to 1900, we were in the Little Ice Age, where they had the frost fairs at the River Thames. This sort of stuff is interesting. People are interested that the Thames used to freeze over. The Earth is our home. It's where we live. We're invested in its future. We want to know what's happening with the weather. It's the first thing the farmers check and the last thing they check when they go to sleep. I mean, we're inbuilt to care about the weather.
And then, of course, at this point, the reporter would say, well, Annika, that's all very interesting. But what I asked you was, are you a climate change denier?
Well, I guess I would say something like, look, man-made climate change has never, ever been proven. So I would never teach something that hasn't been proven because that is not science. And consensus is not science. As soon as someone says the science is settled, I mean, sorry, that's not actually science. That sounds like a bit of a dictatorship.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and you're absolutely right, of course. I was just trying to make the point that in certain areas, and this is one of them, that the mainstream media can get steam
A
rolling.
frenzy.
Yeah, you can't stop it, and you can't, it's very difficult to stand up and say, sorry, I don't believe that.
I was recently asked when I was on GB News with Lee Anderson, this he was a Labour unionist. He asked me, he said, "So, do you believe in climate change or not?" And I said, I comfortably said, "I'm a climate skeptic." And I feel like I can say that, like I say, because I studied it for 4 years. And when you give up that much of your life to something, and then you find out that actually what you were taught was a lie, yeah, I'm going to say, actually, guys, I dedicated my life to this. I thought this was going to be my career. It was a lie. I mean, I'm going to say it.
It's nonsense to say these days that you do have to have certain qualifications to be able to speak to a subject, because all knowledge is there at the end of your mouth, isn't it? And so therefore I tried to keep up with the climate debate over a period of time. Though I remember, I think I
Yeah.
mentioned to you before, the one that really got me in the end was the use of proxies to, because basically there was no temperature measurement temperatures before about 1950, none at all. So the way they established what the climate had done going back in time was through proxies. So you had ice cores, and you had tree rings and various ones. And the one that got me was when they had all these tree ring proxies going back hundreds and thousand years, and they used those to say the temperature in, that period was this, and when they got to then compare the tree ring data with the actual measured data from the 1950s onwards, it didn't match. In other words, when the temperature was getting warmer, the tree ring should have been bigger, but it didn't. It wasn't getting bigger. So what did they decide? That, well, something else must be affecting it then. If the tree ring data is not reliable when we're actually able to compare it with the measured temperatures, then something else must be going on to stop it. They didn't. Say, well, just a minute, maybe that means that tree ring data wasn't of any value at all, which is, would have been to me the obvious conclusion.
This is quite a complex point that you're touching on. So, in general, with proxies, you want to use a wide variety of them. So, there's things like seabed sediment, there's fossilized pollen, there's the ice cores, like you say, tree rings. So, you want to use a large sample size, lots of different types with a very large geographic range. And then when you do that, they're actually pretty accurate. And with the tree ring data, what's called the divergence problem is actually, I think what's happened is with the thermometers at the weather stations, actually about 30% of them don't even exist and they're just estimated. And the ones that do exist, a lot of the time, not all the time, but a lot of the time, they're located near high temperature activities, like they could be on an asphalt runway at an airport. They could be in a car park. There's photos all over the internet. If someone wants to have a look more into this, they should have a look at the work by Alan Watts. And what he does is he goes around and photographs temperature stations all around America just to show that, there's this weather
So
station
when it
in
was
a
first
back.
when it was first put up, it was just a little measurement device in the desert, and then 50 years later, it's surrounded by buildings and
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. And now what's happened in America anyway is they coated the weather stations with a new paint, and it's actually a lacquer. And someone did an experiment with it, and it actually insulates what's inside it. So I think that this is all part of the scam to make these instrumental records higher than they would otherwise be. But we're using the outputs of these climate models for really important real world things, and lots of decisions and financing is created with these outputs. So that's the problem of putting fabricated data into the models. But actually, what I just want everyone to know is that I'm not saying that the Earth isn't warming. We're meant to be warming right now. We're coming out of the Little Ice Age, which was global, not just in Europe. And we're going to see, another few degrees of warming. And there's nothing we can do to stop it. And then it will get cool again. So we've got a few centuries ahead where we are coming into a warming period. And if anyone wants to read about that, they just need to look up Dansgaard-Oeschger cycles. And in 1984, Willy Dansgaard of Denmark and Hans Oeschger of Switzerland published their analysis of the oxygen isotopes in the first ice cores, which are extracted from Greenland, which was some of the proxy data you mentioned, Ken. And they found this cycle. So over the last million years, we've had 600 cycles of warming and cooling, and they're approximately 1500 years. And temperature proxies that gather evidence is all over the world. This is actually natural climate change, and it's completely normal. Carbon dioxide is fantastic for the planet. It does not control temperature whatsoever. And yeah, that's basically summarizes the story.
Great. Well, look, I think we shouldn't underestimate the difficulties that we're going to have. I mean, I know this carbon capture thing at the moment. We're able to get people to say, "Oh, yes, I don't want my back garden dug up for a pipeline," but no, I don't want to say that I don't believe in climate change either. What I'm saying is that the narrative that they've spun is still very strong, and it's going to take quite a lot of information and work to get it knocked down in the next few years.
I think when people start to realize that this is a story that's been evolving for the last 60 years, and it's always been the same case where they're, having this hysteric facts to cause hysteria, and they're saying that it's your everyday activities that's causing it, you driving your cars, eating your meat, and we don't have any time to act. We need to make a decision now, and to create this fear. It's important to care about the environment. I care about the environment so much. I love the earth. That's why I did the course in the first place, because I wanted to try and find a solution for this. And we can have environmental stewardship without making everyone think that the world is going to end. And unless you are complicit, then you're part of the problem. So yeah, I think people are waking up. If there's anything I
And
can do to.
ultimately we've nothing to worry about because, as you say in your paper, that the Earth can fix itself, and there's examples of that going back hundreds of years.
Yeah, exactly. I definitely believe that the Earth is an intelligent system, and it has many feedbacks. And it's been here for about 4.5 billion years. So I
And
don't think it's
there's
going
a certain
anywhere anytime
arrogance in.
soon.
There's a certain arrogance in man, isn't there, who says we are so important on this earth that we are the people who are causing this warming. It's just there's an arrogance in that as well, isn't there?
Yeah, and as we know, it's no coincidence that children at school, if you were taught at school about natural climate change and your teacher said, "So, it's going to be really great for the next 300 years, we're going into a warming and it's going to be similar to the medieval climate optimum, and severe weather and storms are going to decrease and crop yields will increase and the winters will be milder." That's what we've got coming in the next 200 years in Europe. If we had learned that at school, there wouldn't be this whole thing. But because there's so much money in this scam and they have so much success controlling people when we're in this fearful state, and they know that everyone cares about the earth because it's our home, I mean, it doesn't take long to figure out that maybe something is going on here.
Look, that's been great. Thank you very much indeed for having been on the podcast.
Okay, thank you so much, Ken. It's been a
Thank
pleasure.
you very much, Annika. Cheers now.
Okay,
Bye.
bye-bye.